You know what the problem is with knowing a story really well? Is that you believe you know the story really well, and as a result of that, sometimes you miss key components of the story. In our parasha, we speak about, amongst other things, the fourth plague that Hashem brought against the Egyptians, which is the plague of Orev, wild beasts. And we see there that Hashem instructed Moshe to tell Paro the following words. Because if you do not send out my people, then I am going to instigate against you Orev. We'll see what that means. And this Orev will fill the houses of the Egyptians and the earth that they are on. So Rashi takes out of this pasuk those two words, mashliach becha, and he explains as follows. What it means is megare becha, that Hashem says, I'm going to instigate that I'm going to agitate these animals to come and to attack you. V'chein, and likewise, we see much later on in the book of Devarim, we see the expression v'shen behemos ashalachbom, that I will send the teeth of animals against you. And then Rashi says it means l'shoin shisui insitir belaz. It's an expression that means to incite, as we see even in French. So what's Rashi concerned about over here? What needed to be explained? V'pashas kavanosu devor shetevas mashliach eino m'l'shoin shiluach. So clearly it would appear that what Rashi wants to do for us is to help us to understand that the word mashliach is not from the word to send, the typical shin lamed ches root. Like in the beginning of the same pasuk where Moshe tells Paro, if you don't send out the Jewish people, same root, shin lamed ches. So Rashi wants us to know this is a different meaning, even though it's the same root. Rather, this means not to agitate, not to incite issues. So that's what Rashi wants us to know. The word mashliach is different to the word mishaleach, even though they appear to be so similar. And there are a few reasons, three in particular, that force us to understand that that's what Rashi wants to say. Number one, im mashliach b'muvin shel shiluach, well, very obvious. If the word mashliach is from the word to send, then the form of the word should have been mishaleach, like the beginning of the pasuk where Paroi is supposed to mishaleach, send out the Jews. So it's a different form of the word. It obviously must have a different meaning. Number two. B'loshen shlichis, matim yoy saloim mashliach es ha'oroiv becha. Also, if the meaning of the word over here was to send, then the correct structure of the pasuk would have been to send who you plan to send, and then against whom you plan to send. In other words, the pasuk should have said, I will hereby send the Aroiv against you. In fact, the pasuk says, I will mashliach against you the Aroiv. So that already alerts us to the fact that it's not the lashon of shoyleach to send. Ukomoy lekamon. Shoyleach is called Mabgeif Oisaya Libcha, like we see in the next plague, that Hashem says, now I'm going to send all of my afflictions, and then the recipient against you. Whereas in the structure of how the wording of the pasuk is mashliach becha, the word becha is not just the intended recipient, it's part of the concept. If you say incite, so then logically part of the incitement is who you're inciting against. So, mashliach becha, the structure and order of the pasuk works. Number three, im amuvenu shlichis, if we were to suggest that the word mashliach means to send in the classical sense, then mati'im loima mashliach lecha. Whenever you use the word shlichis, you send to somebody. And therefore, the words over here should have been mashliach lecha. I'm going to send animals to you. Oi mashliach eilecha, same concept, towards you. V'loy mashliach becha, whereas becha means like within you or against you. Whereas if you're talking about incitement, then I incite against you. Becha, I incite to you. Then it would make absolutely perfect sense. And so we get it. There are three clearly compelling ideas that help us to understand the word mashliach is different to the word mishaleach. And therefore, Rashi has to tell us what it means. It does not mean to send. Rather, it means to incite, to aggravate. Also, mipnei beis tamim achronim, matik Rashi min hakosuv gam teivas becha, because of the two second reasons that we've just given, which is the order of where becha comes in the pasuk and the choice of word becha rather than lecha, that helps us to understand why Rashi includes in the Dibur HaMaskil, because remember, whatever Rashi puts into the headline is what he intends to explain. So he's not only explaining the word Mashliach, he's also explaining the context of Becha. Therefore, Becha is part of the Dibur HaMaskil. Avshu mefarish raktevis Mashliach, shepirush megare, v'gam achakach befirush oikos oidavahim, megare Becha, so now we understand why he includes the word Becha in the headline, even though ostensibly he's only explaining the word Mashliach, because it helps us to understand the context and it helps to prove to us that it means to incite and not to send. Okay, so we get it clearly. Rashi wants to highlight for us that the word Mashliach is fundamentally different to the word Mishaleach. It does not mean I'm sending animals to you, rather it means I'm inciting animals to attack you. If that's the case, then there are a few questions we must ask on this commentary of Rashi. Number one, if Rashi needs a pasuk to prove to us that this word mashliach is a concept of aggravating or inciting the animals against the Egyptians, why does he look for a proof all the way from Parshas Ha'azinu when ostensibly he's got a better or a more accessible proof from Parshas Bechukoisai, where it says clearly that Hashem will send or aggravate against you Chaya Sasode, the wild animals of the field, which is more aligned with what we're talking about over here. Here we're talking about wild animals. In fact, there's a very good reason why the source from Bechukoisai is better suited as a proof for our conversation than the source in Hazinu. Why? Because b'makas orev har medubar begiroi chayes v'chein b'parshas b'chukoisai medubar begiroi chayes ava b'parshas ha'azinu haloi mefayrosh v'shem behemoy sashalach bom. Because here we're talking about orev, where it was wild animals that were going to attack the Egyptians. And the pasuk in b'chukoisai is also talking about wild animals. Good match. Whereas in ha'azinu it's talking about a domesticated animals. So why would Rashi dafka overlook a proof from similar animals and dafka bring us a proof from later in Torah and from different animals? Also, la'acha shepirishim l'shoin megare, lo malei l'Rashi l'hoisif oid l'shoin shisoi. Also, once Rashi has told us very simply that mashliach means megare, which means to aggravate or incite, why does he then at the end of his commentary then add that it's l'shoin shisoi, which also means to incite? Now you cannot tell me that the word shisoi is used by Rashi to clarify the meaning of the word megare. Why not? Well, for three good reasons. Number one, the same way that a five-year-old student is not going to know what the word megare means, he's going to need help with that, he's not going to know the word shisoi any more than he's going to know the word megare. So if you want to clarify a word, you don't use an equally unknown word to try and clarify. In fact, to the contrary, megare hu bito ya nimtza kame pa'amim b'chum she'hatera ba'oi sh'lashon shisoi eina nimtza saf pa'am b'chumash. The word megare or its various forms appears multiple times in the Chumash. So from there, the student could derive context. Like al tizgorubam, where we're warned that we're not allowed to incite against the Edomim. Okay, it's coming on later in Chumash, but still, there's somewhere to find the context. Whereas the word shisui does not appear in the Chumash at all. So you definitely do not use a more obscure word to try and clarify an unknown word. Number two, beis the fizeh habel las michleshein shisui le megare bechavad rak achar zelach lichtoy v'chein shein mechul. Also, if Rashi wanted the word shisui to explain the word megare, then he should have said megare, which means shisui, and then he should have brought his proof from the pasuk. But he doesn't do that. He tells us megare, then he brings the proof from the pasuk, and then he tells us lashein shisui. And lastly, gimel loy hoyo loy loy ma'atevis megare lasbira ella meshaseh b'chavasur loy. Also, if for whatever reason the word shisoi is more well known, then skip megare and just say, what does mashliach mean? Meshaseh, that I'm going to incite the animals against you. So we need to understand what the word shisui adds to the whole story. And don't try and argue that this word shisui is there for a very specific reason. So if normally the word mashliach means, this is how you might want to answer it. You might want to say, usually the word mashliach just means megare, to agitate. But here it means not only to agitate, but beyond that to incite. Well, it doesn't answer our second question about wanting to put shisui next to megare, because that would definitely tell the story. Not only is this megare, but it's also shisui. Plus, where do we have any indication in the Pshat that there's a double expression in Mashliach? Not only does Mashliach mean Megare, to agitate, but it also means to incite. And by the way, in English, I don't know if we necessarily see as clear a difference between the two words as they would appear to be in the Hebrew. Okay, let's continue further in the Rashi. This is going to be the big issue that we're going to focus on over here. So Rashi then quotes the words, es he'orov. What's Hashem going to incite against the Egyptians? Es he'orov. Now notice that the word es is relevant over here. Es, which doesn't really have a translation, but it's part of what Rashi's commenting on. He'orov. What does he explain it to mean? Mefaresh. What it means is that it will be all kinds of wild animals and snakes and scorpions, all in a confused mass, a chaotic mass of animals. And they then destroyed or attacked or mauled them or whatever they did. And then he explains, v'yesh tam b'dover b'agoda b'chol mako mako lomozoi v'lomozoi. Then Rashi tells us that there is an agada, there's a medrash, or an agada within the Gemara, in other words, something which is non-literal. Here he's quoting Fafim a medrash. What the reason was behind each of the plagues. What it is that Hashem attacked the Egyptians following the kind of strategy that a king would use in a war. The first thing you do in a war is you destroy the water source, so blood, so the river becomes blood. Then, and then you blow shofars in order to get the people nervous. How many legions are coming to attack us? So that was the sounds of the croaking frogs. And that is as we see that the frogs made a terrible noise, like the Medrash Rabbi Tanchuma tells us. Okay, straight away you can see that there are a number of questions on this Rashi. Number one, Divrei Rashi Einu Mekorim Ubemedrash, Ela Shepir Shashu Beshinui Loshen. Firstly, Rashi, as we've said, bases himself on a Medrash, Shmois Rabbah, and yet he doesn't say exactly the same words as the Medrash does. Any time that Rashi quotes a primary source and doesn't use it verbatim, we always ask, why is he using different expressions? Bemedrash Eshem Negel Aminim Shemakasore Beis Deos. In the Medrash, there are two opinions as to what the nature of Oroiv was. One opinion is, one opinion is that it was bears, lions, and leopards. And the second is, that there were various kinds of insects that would have bitten and poisoned them, wasps and whatever else. So the fact that Rashi doesn't get into the specific species of animals, he gives an overarching expression, and he says they were wild or dangerous animals. And that's good enough. Especially because there's nothing in the Pshat that indicates which species of animals it is. So Rashi's quite satisfied just to say animals in the generic sense. And we certainly understand why Rashi does not suggest that these might be insects. Why? Because Rashi himself tells it from the Medrash. So the Medrash says And Rashi talks about this as well. In the case of the frogs, what happened when the frogs ended, when the plague ended? There were piles and piles of frogs all over the place. Why? Because they would only be to their detriment. These smelly piles of rotting frogs. Whereas Aroiv, it says, Lo Nishar Bohem Ad Echad, when the plague ended, they were gone. Why? Because we didn't want the Egyptians, Hashem didn't want the Egyptians to get their furs and their pelts. Now, obviously, if you're going to go with the second view in the Medrash, that these Aroiv were actually insects, then there's no reason why they should have all disappeared. So Mikavan Shigam Rashi Nokatam Zeb Birusha Vlaymesa Aru Kamash Mesa Tfadim Khule Harim Movin Shazel Shaila Sadar Shay Sham Tsurim Vitushin. Because we know that Rashi goes with the view that the reason the Arov was immediately removed from the vicinity is because we didn't want the Egyptians to benefit from their skins and their furs. Obviously, Rashi does not believe that Aroif was insects. So, we get it, why Rashi doesn't specify the species, because it's not relevant to the Pshat, and he uses a catch-all phrase, Chayos Ra'ois, and why he doesn't suggest they're insects is because he goes with the view that there was actually potential benefit in the skins, and that wouldn't apply to insects. Avo, what does raise a question is, Zeh Shehoisif Rashi L'Chei Chayos Ra'ois, U'Nechoshev Akrabim Eni Muvan. So what we don't understand is after Rashi tells us that Aroiv is comprised of wild, vicious animals, why does he feel the necessity to add and snakes and scorpions? Mimonavshach, im bepashas Aroiv hu shekol minei chayos ra'os kol gam nechoshim ve'akravim im kein lama lefarto. If chayos ra'os, if wild animals naturally would include snakes and scorpions, then just like Rashi didn't specify lions and bears, he doesn't have to specify snakes and scorpions. So, as Rashi doesn't go into any other detail of any of the other species, why does he highlight snakes and scorpions? And if snakes and scorpions are not naturally included under the banner of wild, vicious animals, so where does Rashi get it from that there were snakes and scorpions? I mean, either way you look at it, if snakes and scorpions belong to the category of wild animals, you don't have to specify them by name. And if they don't belong to that category, then what evidence do you have that they were part of this plague? Another question on Rashi, Maduam, before Rashi Tafki Paposik Zesh, Yeshtam Bedobucho Mako Mako Lomazoi Belomazoi. Why does Rashi only now in Mako number 4 start to tell us the strategic reasons behind all of the plagues? Dimli Fipshuto Shamikr Dorish Tambucho Mako Mako Lomavi Akadish Borchu, Haraminat Serech Hoyle Forest Tam Zem Mako Soyushina, Semiad Mako Horishina. If, for whatever reason, the Pshat requires us to know the reasons behind the various plagues, then Rashi should have given us the insight somewhere earlier on, in fact, ideally in the first plague. That's the logical place to start to explain why they come and why they come in this particular order. Lama huvul v'lama b'seidezeh. Why these plagues and why in this order? Why does Rashi wait until the fourth Makkah and now say, oh, by the way, do you know why they happened? And in this order, because it's the natural military strategy that Hashem applied to the Mitzrim. Okay, so Yesh Meforeshim. Some of the commentaries on Rashi try to dodge that particular question by suggesting that the first three makos did not need an explanation because they're self-understood from information that we are given in context. Well, the first two makos we know involved the river, the Nile, which was a deity for the Egyptians, and the Torah makes it pretty clear, and Rashi makes it pretty clear, that the first salvo was going to be fired against their deity to show your God is not a God. And now we can get into the details of punishing the Egyptians. And that's why the very first plague is the Nile itself turning to blood, because that is a swipe at their God. And it's pretty clear that although the plague of frogs extended beyond the river, it was primarily a makkah against the river. That's why Moshe was not allowed to be the one to smite the river at that point, because he owed it a debt of gratitude for having saved his life, indicating that the plague was leveled against the river, which was their god. So we don't need Rashi to explain how come it is that there was blood and frogs, because we know it's part of dismantling the religious structure of Egypt, the pagan beliefs that they had. So we can understand the order now. The river turning into blood is a direct attack on their deity. The river producing frogs is a secondary attack, still on the deity, but it's a secondary attack because the river itself kind of remains whole, even though it produces something that's going to harm them. And when it comes to the plague of lice, there too the Torah tells us why there was such a plague. Because that is what forced the necromancers of Egypt to acknowledge that this is God's work. This is the finger of God. There's no way we could do it. So now we know why there is the attack of Makas Dam and Sfardea to attack the God, and Kinim in order to humble the Egyptian magicians. Why do you have to have Oroiv? And therefore the Mefarshim and Rashi say that that's why at this point Rashi says there's a whole military strategy at work over here, and this is the next phase of the military strategy. Okay? Now the problem with this is there are a number of questions that come up on this particular angle and generally on this Rashi. This explanation that itself understood why there were the first three makos and it's only Oroiv that really needs an explanation raises a whole series of questions. Number one, if it's true that we already know why there is Dam Tzvadei Akinim, and Rashi only now needs a medrash in order to explain Makas Oroiv, the plague of wild beasts, in Kain, Eichi Tochein, She Es Hatam Na Makas Oroiv, Einoi Mevi, the most logical question is, it makes no sense. You're arguing that Rashi knows why there is blood, frogs, and lice, and he doesn't yet know why they are wild animals. So what does he do? He quotes a medrash to explain why there is blood and frogs, and he says nothing about Oroiv. He just says, look it up. Look it up yourself in the Medrash Tanchuma. Well, your whole purpose, according to this commentary, was to explain why there is Makas Oroiv. So why don't you talk about it? Number two, according to this commentary trying to explain Rashi, you're telling me that it's self-evident why there was blood and frogs and lies. And that's why Rashi didn't have to ask the question, why were there those particular plagues? Well, the obvious reasons were you're attacking the god of Egypt, Dam and Tzvadea, and you're humbling the sorcerers of Egypt, Kinim. If that's the obvious reason why Rashi didn't have to explain them, how come here in this Rashi, that's not the reason he gives? He gives a completely different reason. He says, "Tachsisei milchama, cut off the water supply, scare them with noises." Mimanavshach, you just told me you didn't have to explain it previously because it was self-understood. And now that you start to talk about Oroiv, you don't explain Oroiv and you give different explanations for Dam Tzvadei Akin. It makes no sense. Number three. According to the angle that these Mefarshim are taking on Rashi, this Rashi is only focused on explaining Oroiv. And that would indicate that what Rashi's talking about over here is different to the first part of Rashi. The first part of Rashi was a definition. What is Oroiv? All kinds of wild animals. The second part of Rashi is a different discussion. Why Oroiv? Now that's not how Rashi operates. So So the way Rashi would normally do it is he would say the word Eser Arov and explain that that means all types of Chayos Rois all mixed together. And then again he would say He Arov, and this time he would explain why Arov. That's normally how Rashi does it. He splits it into, even if it's the identical word twice, he splits it so it's very clear. There we're talking about what, and here we're talking about why. As Rashi just did, not very long ago in the plague of frogs, where he took the word atir and explained it twice, the same word twice with two different angles. So if it is true that Rashi is telling us two independent things, first the definition of Arov and then the reason for Arov, Rashi would have split it into two Rashis with two headlines. Next question. When it talks about the different reasons, according to this Rashi, where he's quoting the Medrash about Tachsise Milchama, this military strategy, so when he talks about blood, he says, it is the military strategy to cut off the water supply. That's the Moshel. He does not translate it into how that played out in the plague of blood. Yet, when it comes to the frogs, he says, it is normal in military strategy to make all kinds of noise to scare your enemies. And so he interprets it. And so the frogs made noises to scare them. One, now do you have to interpret it to the frogs? Yet with the blood, you did not have to interpret it to the blood. Next question. The fact that Rashi not only gives us this medrash, but he highlights that it is agoda, i.e., not pshat. Clearly, Rashi's highlighting for us that this is not the pshat, it's not the simplest understanding. Why? Why does Rashi have to highlight that this does not align with the pshat? Why does it not align with the pshat? Actually, it fits perfectly with the pshat. There's no reason in the simple understanding of the pasuk not to say that Hashem follows a military strategy. So why is Rashi kind of moving it away from pshat? Next question. Lama mesayim Rashi kedisa medrash Rabbi Tanchuma arein darkash Rashi letzayin amok lidvorov. How come at the end of the Rashi, Rashi says, as is explained in the Medrash Rabbi Tanchuma, usually Rashi does not tell us his source unless knowing the source will help us better to understand what's going on over here. So my nafkamina kan, what's the practical difference here to know that it's a Medrash Rabbi Tanchuma? And if Rashi does want to tell us that it's a medrash, why split it into two? At the beginning he says there's a reason ba'agoda, which of course means medrash, and at the end he tells us look it up in medrash tanchuma. Why doesn't he just say at the beginning yeshtam bedover ba'agodas rabbi tanchuma, or ba'agodas medrash rabbi tanchuma, or something like that? Lastly, Lama Matik Rashi min Akosov Gam Tevas Es He'orov, Alei Kol Pirushei Ene Ela B'Tevas He'orov. How come Rashi includes in the Dibra Maskil in the headline the word S if ostensibly all he's explaining is the word He'orov? Okay, many questions on this Rashi. So again, Rashi goes through all the military strategies, which the Meforshim want to say is because we knew what all of those, what the reasons were behind the other Makos, and it's only this one that suddenly raises a question for us. And we said, no, that really doesn't make any sense, because then he should have started to explain it before. Why doesn't he give the reason over here for Orov? Right? Should give us for Orov. Why does he change the reasons for the others? Why doesn't he split it into two different commentaries? Why does he only explain, play out the nimshal of frogs and not of blood? Why does he say that it's agoda? Why is that so important? Why does he split it and say agoda in the beginning and medrash Rabbi Tanchuma at the end? Usually Rashi does not explain what his source is. And why does he use the word S in the headline? So we have many, many questions of what appeared to be quite a simple story. Never again, it's a story we all know. We know the story. We know Arov. We know that it's wild animals. And yet there are so many questions over here. And of course, the core question we have to ask ourselves, and that's what we're going to focus on, is what is the uniqueness of this plague? Habir b'chol zehu, the explanation is b'chol mako maka b'noisen shelifnei maka sorev b'noisen shelachreo hariparonusa v'toichon oincha muvan v'nikar. One thing that you can see as a theme throughout all of the makos, all plagues, those that precede Arov and those that follow Arov, is we're always given an idea of what the nature of the plague is and what the nature of the punishment that the plague was supposed to mete out is supposed to be. So im itoich divrei asra shenit le parlif nehavo samaka oi boysna maka shloi kadmal en asra mitoich divrei kadosh baruch hu moshe beish tzivo la seis apul la vi samaka. The clues are either given by Moshe to Paroi, the following plague is coming against your people for the following reason. Or, in the cases of those plagues where Paroi was not warned in advance, which is every third plague pretty much, then we know that at least Hashem tells Moshe, I'm bringing this particular plague for this particular purpose. So he should recognize me, so he should recognize that I have control, that he should free the Jewish people, whatever the thing is. But what you will see as a theme throughout all of the Makos is we're already told what the plague will be before the plague happens. We're either told it in the conversation between Hashem and Moshe or in the conversation between Moshe and Paroi. But before the plague happens, we already know what is about to happen. What's unique about Oroiv is that Moshe tells Paroi, Hashem says, I'm going to incite against you the Oroiv, and they will fill your homes and the land that you're on. Without telling us what Oroiv is. At face value, Oroiv means a mixture, but we're not told a mixture of what. And therefore, Mahi Pura Nuso, what is the actual punishment? What will the devastation be? So with blood, we're told the river's going to turn into blood. You're not going to have water to drink. With the frogs, we're told the frogs are going to come and they're going to fill your homes and they're going to get into your ovens and into your food and whatever, etc. Here, we're just told there's going to be Oroiv. That's quite a generic word. That means mixture. Mixture of what? That will do what? So therefore we have to say that the word mashliach or the phrase mashliach bicha mudgeshes mahutzah shomaka zoi ufuranusa, that holds the clue as to what the nature of this particular maka is and what the devastation will be. I don't see it clearly in the word oroiv, but I am going to see it in the word mashliach. All I know from what's going to follow is that it will be something of irbuvya, that's what oroiv means, a mixture. And I know that it's going to affect everybody because he says it's going to be you and your houses and the land that you're on. So Lochem Pirish Rashi, therefore Rashi says, I need to explain what this word Mashliach means, because that is the linchpin for understanding the entire story. Mashliach Becho means Megara Becho. That Mashliach means to incite. Shemitzad HaHechech HaMuvel Il Sifalef Lefarish Mashliach Megara Yuvan Gam Mi Uma Hu HaOroiv. We already explained before how Rashi knows that it has to be Mashliach, not Mishaleach. In other words, that it means to incite, not to send, because of the structure and order of the words, because of the pasuk that Rashi brings, because of the Becha rather than the Licha. So he knows that it means to incite. Now that we know that it means to incite, that will be the clue to understanding what the nature of this plague is. What is Oroiv? So we just got a word Oroiv, which means a conglomerate of things that are going to somehow attack the Egyptians. So Mashliach is the clue. What kind of things can be incited? That's what Rashi wants us to know. What kind of things can be incited? Mi sheshayech boi inyan hagiroi. Where is it relevant to use the expression to incite? V'hainu ha-barichayim. That's with animals. K'shemegorem es ha-barichayim ha-rimum v'pasha sh'noishchum mashchisim v'chulei. Now it all fits into place. Now I know what the nature of the plague is. If I incite animals, then they're going to attack. And if they're going to attack, they're going to bite, they're going to maul, they're going to claw, whatever they're going to do. But they're going to harm. Now I understand what the nature of this plague is. From the word Oroiv, I didn't know what it means. Mashliach helps me to understand it is beings that can be incited to become aggressive and to attack. So Mashliach teaches me what's going to happen over here. Hashem is going to incite a whole lot of wild animals and they are going to wreak mayhem in Egypt and attack the people top to bottom, and it's going to be devastation. Now, behine, zesh atir mefaretes, rak zesh bo be'oroiv, be'irbuvya, mikola protim shememaka, v'ad shalai pirshe so'ika l'cheir shebo chayis v'chulei. Now, immediately, we realize something really interesting. Out of all of the details of what could have happened, what kind of animals they were, how they were going to attack, where they were going to come from, etc., what does the Torah focus on? Oroiv. The fact that they were a mixture of animals. Machriach loimar. Right, sorry, and all the details of the fact that it was animals that would be incited against it, that we get from other words, mashriach b'cha. But the key word, and this is what the plague gets named, oroiv, means mixture. If that's what the Torah is focusing on, machriach loimar, that means the word oroiv will teach us something about the nature of this plague we would not have otherwise known, and in fact it's going to emerge as the biggest chidush, the biggest insight into what the nature of this plague is. Vehu. Ikera chidush v'neis. V'neis yeh shebo chayis chulei. Hoya shebo harbe minei chayis bi'irbuvya. The Torah wants us to know, and this is really important, the Torah wants us to know that the biggest miracle out of this plague was the fact that the animals came as a mixture. The fact that animals were sent to attack them, that we get from Mashriach B'cha. And that is the nature of this particular plague, that it will be this whole major animal droves of animals coming through and attacking people. But Oroiv, the fact that different species of animals came together, that is the main miracle that's happening over here. Any other detail of this particular plague is not an unusual miracle. The unusual miracle is dafka, the mixture. So we must focus on the mixture. Vinkei muchach loimar sherak chayos hoyu beha oroi veloi behemais. So therefore, the first thing we have to recognize is that the nature of the animals that came was dafka chayos, wild animals, and not behemais, domesticable animals. Why? Because if domesticable animals had also attacked the Egyptians, that would have been an additional miracle. And then the Torah would have had to tell us that. It's miraculous for cows and sheep to start attacking people. So if that were the case, the Torah would have highlighted. The Torah doesn't. The Torah says, what was the miracle? Aroi, that out of the wild animals that came, the fact is that they came together. So we have to know that the Torah wants to emphasize for us that the miracle over here is the mixture of wild animals. Ah, but then you'll have a question. Hang on a second. If it's true that the only animals that attacked the Egyptians in this Makkah were already wild, i.e. aggressive animals, why do we need Mashliach? Why does Hashem have to incite them? They don't need to be incited. They're wild animals. They're predators. This is what they do. If it were domesticable animals that were included in this particular plague, we'd understand why Hashem had to incite them, because it's unnatural for them to attack. But if we're excluding domesticable animals and we're insisting that they are dafka animals that are already wild, like in the story of the brothers when they wanted to sell, when they wanted to claim that Yosef had been killed, what do they say? Chayara achalosu, he was attacked by a wild animal, and Yaakov accepted it because it's normal that wild animals attack. So why do we need giroi? Why do we need Hashem to incite the animals to attack? Therefore, Rashi says, it's not just megare, it's shisui. Shisui is inciting, like the Rambam talks about what happens if a person incites a dog to attack another person. Are you chayev, you know, for having killed them? Or when people have, like, you know, the matadors and these kind of things, when they incite an animal, that's more than megare. That's shisui. That's when you really, really agitate the animal. So what Rashi wants to illustrate is, even though the word Mashliach, as Rashi points out, means to incite, we need to appreciate that there are different levels and degrees of incitement. There's the normal incitement which a wild animal does not require because it's already wild and it's already a predator and it's already going to attack. And then you have shisui, which is a process where you egg the animal on to go even beyond its nature. You know, there's certain animals in the wild, trust me, from Africa. Certain animals, most predators in the wild at the end of the day will not attack you. That's the bottom line. Unless they need to eat or they feel threatened. So if you are able to know how not to appear as a threat to them, you could literally be face to face with the animal and you'll be fine. Shiso is when you provoke the animal. So even though the animal is a wild animal, once you provoke it, it will behave against its nature and attack, even if it's not feeling threatened and even if it's not looking for food, hunting for food. That's what we're talking about. So what Rashi wants us to know over here is, if you would take a whole lot of lions and drop them down in Egypt, they wouldn't naturally start attacking people. Not necessarily. So there was a provocation, there was a shisui. Over and above the fact that Megara, that Hashem's going to send wild animals that are naturally aggressive and hunters and predators, Shisui is going to provoke them dafka to attack. But that's not a unique miracle. That's part of nature. That is the nature of any creature. You provoke a creature, it will attack. Now we can understand one of the earlier questions that we asked. Why does Rashi Dafka bring a pasuk to prove this concept of provocation from Pashas Hazinu, which is so much further in the Torah, and talking about domesticable animals instead of Bechukoisai, which is closer and talking about similar wild animals? That's exactly why. That's why Rashi Dafka quotes a pasuk that talks about domesticable animals to illustrate that we're talking here about provoking the animal to behave in a way that is not natural for it. That's why it talks about domestic animals, because it's not natural for them to attack unless you provoke them, like the running of the bulls or the matadors or whatever. It's not natural. But when you provoke the animal, it's going to attack you. So now we understand the flow of Rashi. What does Mashriach mean? Megara, to provoke. How do we know Mashriach means provoke? Because look, the Torah uses that word about getting a naturally domestic animal to behave in an aggressive way. So now I know that the word mashliach means to provoke. But here we're talking about wild animals. Surely doesn't take much provocation. Therefore, Rashi says, in this particular context, it was shisui. Hashem provoked them in an unusual fashion so that they should become even more aggressive. But that is not necessarily miraculous. It's just the nature of provocation. Now, once we know that Mashliach Becha means to provoke the animals to be even more aggressive than normal, now we can have a look at how Rashi explains the words Ese Oroiv. Any Koroi Lefaret Mi Hoyo Be Oroiv. Rashi is not interested to tell us which species of animals were incorporated in Oroiv. That was already alluded to in Mashriach Becha. Wild animals. Animals that can be provoked to aggression. We already know what that is. Now Ese Oroiv doesn't have to explain any further which animals that is. What Rashi wants us to know in the words Es He'orov is that is the main miracle of this Makkah. What? The fact that different species of animals came together and they were, it's completely unusual for them to be together. Again, speak to the people from Africa who tell you, lions and leopards are natural enemies. They'll hunt in the same areas and they'll attack each other. Now suddenly you got them side by side attacking the Egyptians together. That is unnatural. That is a nes miyuchad. That is not normal. And we came to talk little of Shabbat Bir Buvi and Moisef Gam come in a chais rois and chashav akramim. Kibozem farishas har buvi shoyz mako zoi. And because Rashi's primary goal over here is to highlight the incredible nais of the conglomerate of different species of wild animals together attacking, therefore he tells us chayos rois and chashav and akramim, as we'll see. That also explains why Rashi includes in his title, in the Dibra Maskil, the extra word es, because that highlights even more for us that the primary miracle over here is the mixture of the animals, not the attack of the animals, the mixture of the animals. Because if it's not the primary miracle, and it's just a detail, it so happens that there was a miracle of wild animals, and it so happens that they were together, if that were the case, well, then the word S is like a specific term, right? S is, this is what I'm sending. So, if Aroiv is a detail of the bigger story, then Ese Aroiv seems to limit the story. I'm sending wild animals, Ese Aroiv. Whereas if the purpose of the story is to highlight that the biggest miracle over here is Ese Aroiv, the fact that they came all together as a united front, then S works very well because it emphasizes for us, herein lies the miracle. Ese Aroiv, the coming together of all the animals, that's the miracle. Now we understand why Rashi doesn't get into the details of bears, lions, and leopards. We have absolutely zero evidence from any pshat what kind of animal species were common in that area, in that region. Nothing at all. We have no evidence at all. So therefore, according to pshat, there's no reason why it should be those species of animals. There's nothing to indicate that bears or lions or leopards were native to that area. Now, let's just say, as happens to be the case, let's just say that bears are not native to Egypt. Then there would have to be an additional miracle, which is possible. The Medrash talks about it. In the Medrash is the concept of animals from all over the world that were miraculously transplanted and dropped down into Mitzrayim. And the Medrash even goes so far as to say, with their natural habitat so they wouldn't feel afraid. Like the famous story with Elisha, where the Dubim and Ya'ar, was there a forest? Were they not? Were they just bears or a forest as well? Okay, not for now. Rashi doesn't want to get into that because then that indicates that the miracle of Aroiv was the importing of foreign animals. There's no evidence of that in the Pshat. So Rashi doesn't want to get into the names. I don't know which animals were indigenous, and I don't know if animals were imported. All I know from the pshat is the fact that they were a mixture of animals. V'lochen kosev Rashi chayis rois stam. Hana chayis rois shayim mitzuyis oz b'svivus gvul mitzrayim mibli leferet eze chayis hoyu. Therefore Rashi is satisfied to use a generic term, wild animals. Whichever wild animals worked, those are the wild animals that were there. But we do now understand how come it is that Rashi had to insist, even though he uses a generic term, which could apply to all kinds of animals, he dafka specifies snakes and scorpions. Why? Because the pasuk concludes that the plague of Aroiv was also going to affect the earth on which they were. Notice the emphasis, they. If the pasuk had said, "Umale ha'aroiv," this mixture of animals will fill your houses and the earth, then the impression would be that aroiv is the haim, the land that haim, that they, the aroiv, are on. They will fill that land. But that's not how the pasuk goes. And my kevin shekasim mother bottom mitzrayim es he aroiv goyim bottom mitzrayim ha'ikar. But once the Torah says umalu bottom mitzrayim, what's the focus of the pasuk? The focus is on the houses, and those houses will be filled with wild animals. If that's the case, v'gam ha'adom asher bottom ha'yamitzim aleh umalu es aroiv. Then the land they are on, they refers to the houses. That this makas aroiv will fill the earth that the houses are on. Now, it would have made perfect sense to say the animals will fill the earth that they tread on if the main subject of the pasuk had been the aroiv. But because of the nature and structure and grammar of the pasuk, the main subject of the pasuk is the houses, then somehow we're saying that the land the houses are on will be filled with aroiv. That doesn't seem to make sense. And just to put a cherry on the top, void v'ikar b'chol parsha zoi ha'arav hu l'shein yochit v'yavoi v'sar v'yosar v'imken ablemim asher hu aleha. Plus, if in fact we were talking about the arav filling the whole land throughout this entire conversation, arav is always referred to in the singular. And then it should have said the land asher hu aleha, the land it is on. Therefore, therefore, we have no alternative but to say that according to Pshat, Asher Heim Aleha, the land they are on, the they is either the Egyptian homes or the Egyptians themselves. Somehow the Torah is telling us that the land itself is filled with Aroiv. Really? How does that happen? That implies that the Arev is inside the earth. Now, it's completely unnatural that lions, leopards, elephants, I don't know what was there, should be inside the earth. Plus, we've already said that the big miracle over here was the fact that they were a mixture. And any other miracles should have been alluded to in the pasuk. Therefore, Rashi says it's clear that there had to have also been snakes and scorpions. Why? Because it's natural for snakes and scorpions to be within those holes and ditches and wells inside the earth itself. And we know this already. As we famously know, in the case where the brothers threw Yosef into an empty pit, Rashi says empty of water, but there were snakes and scorpions. In other words, Rashi's already told us that it is natural to have snakes and scorpions in the ground. Therefore, nothing unnatural about finding that part of the attack of vicious animals included snakes and scorpions in the land. Now, what's interesting is Rashi does not bring this as an independent interpretation of the words. Not only that, he doesn't even allude to it with using a vegoimer and etc. in his headline. Why? Why? Because Rashi, as we've already determined, is not focused on what kind of species of animals were part of the Aroiv. He's focused on telling us that Aroiv was a miracle of mixture. Oh, by the way, it's interesting to note that this includes snakes and scorpions, which tackles a little bit of a misunderstood phrase within the pasuk. Moving right along, the main focus is to tell you that there was this miraculous mixture of animals. Fine, so now Rashi has told us and highlighted that the Torah wants us to know that the big miracle over here was the fact that many animals came together and they collaborated. Why is that such a big deal? Why was that necessary? We understand that it's a miracle, but why is that miracle important? To answer that, Rashi gives an explanation that it has to do with military strategy. Rashi uses the preceding, what the Medrash has to say about the preceding makos, he uses that to help us understand what would be so powerful about the mixture of animals in this mako. So what did he tell us? Told us tachsisim mechomes menochim bo aleim chule v'chakach toiken aleim memrim b'sheiforis liarim v'levolam v'chem etzvad mekark b'hoim v'chule. He told us that it's a military strategy, glossed over how it works in the story of the blood, just briefly saying there's a concept of cutting water supply, and then he focuses on the tzvardim where what? They make a lot of noise to instill fear in the enemies. That's what Rashi wanted us to know. Part of military strategy is you do things that are going to completely spook your enemies. Logically, we get it. Now that we have seen the story of the frogs, we get it. One of the most important military strategies is to instill fear in the hearts of your enemies, whether it's by making noise, as in the frogs, or likewise here in Oroiv. Tam shehiv esachais birbuvu hu gedel yaramu levolom ki kasher achais komin atzmoi ana eina behol gedel kol kach ava kishe boim harbe chais me harbe minim u beir buvya oz ava behol beir gedel beyoser. Just imagine for a second if there happened to be a lion, a leopard coming through a village in the old days, which wasn't uncommon. There was fear, but it was natural fear. That's what happened in those days. Wild animals would wander into human habitat and attack people. Happened up until the last century. But if you suddenly hear that there are lions and leopards and crocodiles, who knows what was going on over there? There's a terrible fear. We've never experienced this before. So that's what Rashi wants us to know. Rashi wants us to know not the details of each makkah, how it worked, but the concept that we learn from it, which is that a big part of the makkos was to cause fear by the Egyptians. Now we get why Rashi did not talk about this in any of the earlier makkos, and why he does not separate it from his conversation about the nature of Orev Izir Buvia, because it's not a separate conversation. Maybe Raktam shall base Makos or Yishanis Harak, Rak Adatam Makas Svardevelo Yosikibikala Makos Lemiskam Rashi Babios and Midrash. Now we get why Rashi didn't get into all of the four Makos. He just needed to get us to the point of knowing what happened with the frogs, because that helps us understand the psychology of war, which helps us to understand Orov, and it all fits together. We've answered all of our questions in one shot. It's not a separate explanation to Ha'arov is Komin Echayis Bir Buvya. That is his point. The Komin Echayis Bir Buvya is the Tachsisa Milchama. That is the strategy of war that's being applied over here. The strategy of striking fear in your enemy's hearts. Over Mele, Moving Gam Ken Lama Mefor Shashi Anim Sharak B'Makas Tzvardea Ki Rak Al Danim Shem Makas Zoy Yodim Shem Makas Zoy Yodim Shem Yarim Levolam. Now we get it why Rashi does not have to get into the details of how you apply the Tachsisa Milchama in the story of blood, but you do need to know in the story of frogs. Why? Because the story of frogs, the take-home message of the story of frogs, is going to be relevant to us to understand Orov. Fear. Vafal Bichain, in spite of all of that, Muchach Rashi Lahakdim Shetam Zenema Ba'agoda. Rashi still has to remind us that this is all Agada. Even though it does have a place within Pshat to explain all of the things that we have explained, because as we mentioned earlier in the Sicha, according to Pshat, we already know why we had to have blood, frogs, and lice. Blood and frogs in order to diminish their sense of deity. And in the case of the lice, in order that the sorceress should be humbled. That's why Rashi has to tell us this is Agada, because we already have explanations according to Pshat for the various makos that preceded Oroiv. It's just that in order to understand the Pshat of Oroiv, we have to get the Medrash of the earlier makos. So therefore, what have we done? We've used a medrash to help understand pshat, which is exactly what Rashi does. That's Rashi's classic style. Quote a medrash where it will help you understand pshat. I need to understand in the pshat here why Arov was dafka a miracle of mixing different species of animals. In order to get that, I need a medrash of different reasons besides the pshat for why there was blood and frogs and even lice. But it's still not 100% glat. It's not 100% smooth. Why? The question we're about to raise is not a mega question, and the answer is kind of an alluded to answer. Still, we're going to tackle it anyway. We get it that to bring a mixture of animals to attack the Egyptians all at once is overwhelmingly frightening. How come it is, Taka, that the Pasuk makes that the focus, and the fact that they were attacked by wild animals seems almost completely overlooked? How could that be? So Rashi doesn't tackle it directly, but he alludes to it. He says, go look in the Medrash Rabbi Tanchuma. Because if you look in the Medrash Tanchuma, you know what you're going to find? You're going to find that in the plague of frogs, the croaking of the frogs was harsher for the Egyptians than the fact that there were frogs. And from that, you can extrapolate that here too, the fact that the animals came in a mixture was worse than the fact that there were wild animals attacking them.
And that's where Rashi just leaves us with an etc.
He doesn't need for us to get into all the other details brought in the Medrash about all the other makos. He just wants that particular point. That yes, you might think that the main thing is that they were attacked by wild animals, so you need to know that the Arov was worse than the attack itself. The mixture overwhelmed them more than the fact that they were being attacked by wild animals, similar to how the sound of the frogs was worse for them than the frogs itself.
Okay, so now that we've looked at the fact that there are two different approaches, there's the Pshat approach, which is that the first three plagues were there really to bring the Egyptians to their knees, to destroy their sense of their pagan ideas. And then there's the Medrash approach that was this military approach. So we're going to learn something really interesting over here, that there are various different Rishonim who all give different explanations as to who was or wasn't affected by which of the Makos. In other words, were the Jews completely immune or not? And what's the take-home lesson from that? So Makas Orev Kosev Achakach Yifleis Beryomuhu Eseretz Goyshen Asher Amioi Medoleho Levilti Hayosham Orev Vegoymer. Here in the story of Orev, Hashem makes it very clear that Moshe should tell Paroi that this is a time that I'm going to distinguish between Goyshen, where the Jews live, and the rest of Egypt. There will be no Orev where the Jews live. Now that raises a question, obviously, right? It raises a question, how come with the first three, with blood, frogs, and lice, how come there doesn't emphasize that the Jews were unaffected by those plagues? If it is self-understood that obviously the plagues were for the Egyptians, isn't that what the Psukim say, right? The Psukim say that the whole purpose of these plagues was to get the Egyptians to recognize Hashem. So logically, the plagues only affected the Egyptians. If it's so obvious, why in the case of Arov do we have to be told that the Jews, Dafka, were immune? So there are various opinions. We're going to look at three different opinions. The Evan Ezra suggests that the first three plagues also affected the Jews. And the Jews were a little bit inconvenienced by blood, by frogs, and by lice. Rak makas ha'orev shoyse kosho hoya Hashem hifrish ben amitzim ben Yisrael. It's just that when it came to Arov, that was literally life-threatening, people being attacked and mauled in the streets, then Hashem said, okay, now the Jews are immune. So according to the Eben Ezra, the first three affected the Jews. Omnam harad vaz b'tshuvosa koisa, that vaz completely disagrees with us. He says, mashakosa rav Eben Ezra, ki makas dom v'atzvad, makin moizim v'tshayim v'yisrael, osur laham in dovar zeh. The Advas says, God forbid to believe what the Eben Ezra suggested, that the Jews were impacted by the first three makos. He says, Kol sheken shaksuvim morim lehefech. He says, the Advas says, all the psukim indicate the exact opposite. V'lo yochlu mitzrayim lishtois min ayor, v'yachmur mitzrayim svivas ayor, mashma, v'li solo yotzichm lezeko yishes min mei mayor. The Radvaz says, clearly the Psukim tell us the Egyptians could not drink from the water, and the Egyptians started to dig around the Nile trying to find water, implying it was the Egyptians that had this problem, not the Jews. Likewise, when it comes to the frogs, the Torah says clearly that they were going to affect you and your people. And Hashem later says, I'm going to take them away from you and your people. Mashma, implying that the Jews were unaffected. V'chein akinim, and the same applied to the lice. V'yom etzosim in ha-meforash, and therefore the Radvaz says, those that are not specified in the Torah, you can extrapolate from those that are specified. And v'lo yodaiti ha-mako isagam yisom marayesh bo lefarash yishalach es Yisrael. Besides the fact that there's evidence the Jews were not affected, says the Radvaz, what would the purpose of the plagues be if the whole point of the plagues is to humble and bring Egypt to its knees? How does it achieve that if the Jews are also being affected by the plagues? So the Eben Ezra says the first three affected the Jews, the Radvaz says not a chance. But Rambam bepirsha Mishnah's kesev, the Rambam says, Shemakas damat svardei lo yohoyu bisrol klal, blood and frogs did not affect the Jews at all. Avo mashenke makas kinim oisod gam bohem avalo yohoyu mitzarim oisod. But the kin and the lice, the Jews did have lice, but it was very mild and it didn't actually cause them any pain and discomfort. What does Rashi say? The fact that when it comes to Mako number 4, and Hashem says, I'm now going to distinguish between the Jews and the Egyptians, and Rashi doesn't say a word, that means that Rashi says the Pshat indicates that the Jews were impacted by the first three plagues. In fact, possibly a hint to that is that when it comes to the lice, it says that it affects Ba'adam, the people, without saying the Egyptians or your people or any of those expressions. And unlike the Rambam, according to Pshat, there is no evidence that the lice, if it did affect the Jews, did not cause them pain. Radical insight that I don't think the average person necessarily realized, that according to Pshat, the first three makos affected the Jews. Why? Because the Pshat says, makas oroim. Now Hashem says, I'm going to distinguish between my people and yours. What about the Radvaz's questions? I mean, again, the Radvaz, why does the Torah emphasize that it's going to affect the Egyptians? Because that's the message we're trying to get across. We're trying to get across a message to Paro. This is for you. Doesn't mean we're not going to be affected, but the message is for you. However, the last question that Radvaz said, but how are the Egyptians going to learn their lesson if the Jews are also being afflicted, appears to be a good question. So there's two questions you have to ask. The first question is, how would it be an indicator, dafka, to Paro that he should listen if the Jews are also being affected? And the other, maybe bigger question is, why would the Jews be affected by these makos? Move on. Except that based on what we've already learned, it actually starts to make sense. Rashi says, why did Hashem attack blood and frogs first? To attack the deity of the Egyptians. It doesn't matter who can't drink the water. The fact is, their deity has been paralyzed. Doesn't matter who's affected. The goal was to show that I am Hashem and this is nonsense. Well, that's been achieved. If the Jews also have to scrounge for water, according to Pshat, we know the Midrashim about selling water, etc. But according to Pshat, if the Jews also cannot find water, it doesn't change the fact that the Egyptian god has been crippled. On the contrary, what the Rebbe is going to say now is fascinatingly brilliant. Logically, if the goal is to prove that the Egyptian deity is dead, is meaningless, then the Jewish people have to be affected as well. Let's assume that the Nile Delta all turns to blood, except in Goshen. Paroi, in his corrupted, skewed version of life, is going to say, well, in that part of Egypt, my God is still stronger than God. That Hashem. Hashem couldn't get to the Goshen area. So we're all going to go worship the Nile in Goshen or something ridiculous like that. So according to Pshat, because the goal of this Makkah was to show that the Egyptian deity is nonsense, it had to affect every part of the Nile Delta, including where the Jews were. V'aderech zeh Makkas Kinah. The same thing with the concept of the lice, where the goal of the lice was to show that Hashem is in control. It's Hashem's finger. That's as much as the sorcerers were willing to admit at that point in time. So it had to be that Hashem's power is everywhere. What was the argument up until that point in time? The sorcerers would say, you Moshe and Aaron are sorcerers, we're sorcerers. You make blood, we make blood. You make frogs, we make frogs. Now you make lice, we cannot make lice. Okay, you're greater than us. But you can't make lice on the Jews. So you're still human sorcerers. And the message we need is Etzba Elohim, meaning that Hashem has no restrictions, no limitations. So by Pshat logic, the Jews had to have lice as well. Whereas when it comes to Arov, we're no longer about proving Hashem's supremacy. That's been achieved. Now we're punishing the Egyptians. Punishing! There's no reason the Jews should be punished. Now Hashem says, I'm going to distinguish the Jews from everybody else. What's the lesson? Powerful lesson. On a spiritual level, why is it dafka b'makas orev that that's when you have the distinction between the Jews and everybody else? The first three plagues, as we've illustrated, you don't have to show a difference between the Jews and the Egyptians. Why? The first three makos are attacking the pagan beliefs of the Egyptians. So if the Jews are also suffering, no Jew is now going to think, oh, maybe the Egyptians are right. Maybe we should be part of Egyptian society. Maybe we should assimilate. When it comes Arov, suddenly the Jews say, whoa, hang on, Hashem has just changed the rules of nature. Up until now, the rules of nature are that lions and leopards don't hunt together. And snakes and leopards don't go to the same place. Hashem has removed the barrier. Now, you never know how strangely people could think, but people could think. Hashem has also likewise removed the barrier between Jews and non-Jews. So now Hashem Dafka says, be flacy. Dafka now, when you have the suggestion, when you have the slightest inkling that perhaps there are no boundaries between different life forms, and therefore there are no boundaries between Jews and non-Jews, comes along Hashem and says, be flacy. Dafka now, we're going to see that there is a clear, impossible barrier between Jew and non-Jew. Vayiro mizeh muvenes bepashtus, which gives us a very clear message for our generation. Dafka b'shoa asher buvya ba'olam uvizman asher potzu gidur shel olam ba'ofen sheloi hoyo lo'olamim, when you live in a time as we do, when all the things that used to naturally divide between anything logical, between different kinds of behaviors, the genders, whatever it is, it's all fallen down. It's dafka a time where we have to highlight and emphasize the distinction between Jews and the rest of the world. If Hashem wanted to make that crystal clear through miraculous means before the Torah was given, before we were the chosen nation, and then already Hashem had to say, and we are distinct absolutely from the Egyptians, how much more so nowadays? Post the Torah, post the Von of Acharta that Hashem chose us. And this absolute barrier is applicable to every single Jew. Even those Jews who did not want to leave Egypt and eventually did not leave Egypt. Which reminds us that the absolute distinction between Jew and everybody else is for every single Jew, even the Jew in name. And that's why, God forbid, to those people who refer to their fellow Jew who might not be as religious as them, as God forbid, non-Jewish. We dare not say such a thing. Even the Jew who is only Jewish in name is absolutely distinct from the rest of the world. When you have the right barriers, the right boundaries in place, when we know our unique and special place within society, and that we are fundamentally different from the rest of the world, then there can be no barrier between us and Hashem, and then each of us is aroused to do tshuva, which brings Mashiach now.